I'd like to thank the program committee for inviting me today. And I was thinking about sort of talking about some more sort of older things, and I decided against and wanted to share with you some of our very, very recent attempt at analyzing neuroimaging data sets. But there is a real twist, and this is a very interesting experiment. So hopefully we can all get interested and excited about the problem. This is very, very much interdisciplinary work. This is joint work with the Princeton people that have been involved in this competition. Close collaboration with Pear, whose programming skills I really envy. So, at least my understanding of functional imaging was that we were interested in finding regions associated with very simple sort of cognitive or sensory tasks. In fact, Descartes was sort of ahead of the time in the sense that he wanted to find, you know, the coordination between vision and motor action. So there is now an emerging new paradigm where instead of scanning people, just listening to some music or watching a very simple visual stimulus in an MRI magnet, they actually have a subject sitting in the magnet for an hour watching a movie. And so they need to collect data. So every second or every 3 seconds, there is a snapshot of the brain activity as the subject is watching the movie. And the problem is, what do we do with the data? It's clearly a very fascinating data set, but how do we analyze that? What do we make of it? It's clear that, you know, the person is being bombarded with stimuli, visual, auditory, a lot of cognitive memory associations, but how do we actually make sense of the data? So this is the type of data set I'll be talking about today. However, this is a better formatted data set in the sense that we have some ground truth about what the subject are thinking or doing. So this is part of a competition where a person is sitting in an MRI machine watching, basically playing a video game, so in a virtual environment. So the advantage is, because it's a virtual environment, people can actually see what the subject is doing. The other advantage is that it's sort of a free environment in the sense that each scan, each data set will be different for each subject because the person will be doing different things. So the subject is asked to perform certain tasks, he has to search for object, look for people, he receives instructions on a cell phone, and then there is a threatening dog in the environment. The data are fMRI data, so functional MRI data, that are highly correlated with brain activity. And there is, in addition, a pupil tracking system so that we have information about whether the subject was actually paying attention to the virtual environment. Does that make sense? Okay. So this is sort of an example of what this is. Projector is a little dim, but basically that's what the subject is watching. There's the dog, there's some objects, and it's meant to be realistic. I really have no experience in video games, so I cannot tell you. So what is the game here? The game is to use functional data, so the state of the brain, to predict some objective and subjective features about what the subject is experiencing throughout the environment. So there is 25 time series that we need to be able to predict. Some of them are objective. Certain times that instructions are given, the subject is conducting a certain task, the dog is appearing, the subject is looking at certain objects in the scene. So this is sort of 0 and 1. Then there are some graded features that are objective, that basically are recorded. So we have the numbers for these. And then there are sort of more subjective. So the subject is asked to, you know, quantify his happiness, level of anxiety, whether he's calm or you know, anxious, annoyed or angry by the cell phone or the dog. And so this is the time series, you know, first of all, this is the level of arousal as a function of time. And here, one unit corresponds to one sample of the brain. So we're, this is much slower than seconds. This is basically every 3 seconds or so. This is velocity or parameter that describes the motion of the subject within the virtual environment. So what is the challenge? The challenge is using the brain data. So we have two rounds of 700 time samples, each of which is composed of a volume of 34 by 64 by 64 voxels. So we can train our algorithm with that. And then we need to predict 25 time series at 704 time samples. And we, of course, there is a ground truth. And so we are going to see how well we're doing by just measuring the correlation between the time series. So in a sort of a schematic way, this data is given to us. We have all the brain information. We know the beginning of a time series, and we need to predict the remaining a third. Does your problem make sense, everyone? Otherwise, it's just going to be a waste of time. Yes, Governor.
Two questions. What's the magnet? How many tests?
It's a 3T magnet.
That's 3T. Are you compensating for heartbeat?
So there's lots of pre-processing being done, yes.
Because when you're playing a game, and the heartbeat can...
Yes.
So it's
we'll talk about that,
okay.
Yeah. So, okay. So I'll be using some notation. I think about the data set as a big matrix, where this is going to be one three-dimensional brain sort of put into a column, basically. So we'll have capital N voxels. Capital N is, you know, about 130,000. And this is time going in the other direction. So a row corresponds to, at a given voxel, a time series. So the goal is, given this entire data set, to predict the remaining part of the feature. I will be calling the feature F sub K. And so that's, in a picture of rendition, that's this. So how can we play this game? So the standard method of analysis is going in the other direction. Typically what people do when they do a functional MRI is they have a well-controlled stimulus here. For instance, you know, the light goes on and off as a function of time, or the subject is, you know, is watching, you know, certain type of objects, you know, watching faces and then watching cars, and then, you know, we expect that somewhere inside here, which is the brain, we expect to see, for instance, the region associated with faces to light up, okay? So changes on a given row will be associated with changes here in the regressor. In this type of experiment, we have this, and we have partial information about that. So it's not going to work. So the sort of general linear model is unlikely to work. So what can people do? Well, they can do sort of voxel selection in the sense that they can use the first two-thirds of the data and find where the, you know, maximum correlation on the first two-thirds here of the data set exists. And so in a sense, sort of handpicking the voxels that appear to be maximally correlated with those features that we know, the training data. And some interesting things happen if we do that. First is that we find the voxels that are maximally correlated with the features, for instance, you know, looking or listening to the cell phone, appear in regions that we don't expect. They're often in regions, for instance, that really are not correlated with the expected, accepted functional areas of the brain. And they're typically very poor predictors of the remaining set of the data. So we need to think about a different way of doing this exercise. So what I have been doing is to sort of think about it as a different setup, in the sense where I think about my data set as a set of values. So those are the voxel. I have capital N voxel as a given of time. And I expect that most of the voxel, most of the values will be correlated to one another. So what I would like to do is to find a parametrization of this vector, with a much smaller number of you know, coordinates here. Typically, I would like to go to n equal several thousand to l equal maybe 30 or 40. In fact, as I will show in the experiments, this is a really good idea in the sense that if I use more than 30 or 40, the ability to predict decreases. And so what I want to think about is the image of the map as being a set of brain states. So for any given time, I have this fMRI data set that will be mapped into sort of an abstract place, and this vector is going to represent what is going on at this time in the brain of the subject. And so I'm going to think about this as a sort of a domain, and fMRI data are going to provide me with samples on that domain, which is sort of the right way to think about the way to study the feature vector. So then we're going to study the feature vector on this domain as opposed to studying them in our thing. So a pictorial rendition, so I have all those data sets, and so I'm going to find a lower dimensional representation of the data and use that to study the feature vector. So how do I do that? Well, the machinery has been sort of explained in a sense by Naoki in the previous talk, and it basically boils down to sort of finding a representation of the data set with a graph and connecting different brain states at different time if the brain states appear to be similar. And so going back to Gilmore's question, for instance, what is a good way to compare two different fMRI data at two different times? We started with some sort of naive idea, for instance, just computing the altitude difference between two different times. Turns out that this is very sensitive. Looking at just the altitude difference is going to be very sensitive to things like blood flow, motion, even if it's corrected. So we need to normalize for global changes in the intensity. So this is a reasonable choice where we basically look at some correlation between two time instant.
So you normalize at this point?
So what I do is I normalize, I basically take the inner product of the two and divide by the norm of the And so, And so then I build a graph so that states that are similar to one another will be connected by an edge, and then I put a weight on the edge, and that will measure, you know, the similarity. I could use this norm, or I could use something else. And then what we're going to do is we're going to do a random walk on this graph, and essentially reparametrize the graph with the eigenfunction of the Laplacian on the graph. So I guess now he did such a great job that I can sort of skip all this part. So at the end of the day, what we have is we're going to take a node here on the graph, which is really the fMRI data set at a given time, and map this column vector of size n to a set of coordinates that are given by the value of the eigenfunction at that node. And I typically I can choose as many as n, but I will typically choose a much smaller number than this to basically reparametrize the data set.
So k starts at 1?
In principle, k starts at 1. K equal 1 is a constant function.
For example,
yes?
How did you pick state
from? OK, I'll talk about that. These are interesting, important details. Okay, so that's the algorithm. We're given the data set, we choose a certain number of eigenfunction, we build the graph, we compute the transition probability matrix, find the eigenvectors of a symmetric version of this, reparametrize the entire data set. Okay. So then what we do is we think about the feature, those time series that we need to predict, as functions that are defined on this sort of domain, the brain state, and our goal is basically to learn the structure or use the training data to find the values of those functions at different times that we didn't observe. So for instance, I have sample here, and I want to find a new sample here. So obviously what I can do, for instance, is some form of interpolation. And so what I need to be able to do is see what this thing corresponds to that, or basically go from a time here to some place here on the domain. So the way I do that is to predict the value of a function or a feature vector at some unknown time, so in the last third of my data set for which I don't have the value of this function, I look at the map, and I know what the value of the map is at that time because I have the data set here. And so that brings me on the domain, and I basically do some interpolation, in this case using some kernel technique, to find the value at the unknown position given the new coordinates that I know, and by weighting accordingly so that I have the new value. So a pictorial rendition of that is I want to find the value at this time. I go back to my data set. I look up the brain data that I have here. I know the map that brings me on the domain here. And so the only thing that I need to do is interpolate the value of this function using the training samples that live around this. Does that make sense? Okay. And so this is actually important. We'll see the examples on real data, how this works. Okay, so those are simple ideas by all means. So I you know, it basically boils down to the fact of whether it works or not. So of course, when we suggested this thing, people said, okay, why don't you just do, you know, a principal component analysis, a single value decomposition of your data set, and use the principal components as your reduced dimensionality, and it's probably going to work as well. And of course we did that, and we've compared. So the way we do the PCA analysis is the principal components are sort of eigenbrains, and so what we do is we project those the function via, each scan is going to give us the projection on those eigenbrains, and we're going to collect a certain number of coefficients. Okay. So how do we think about those eigenbrains? Those eigenbrains, for instance, and we'll see an example, could correspond to brains for which we have, for instance, a very strong sort of oscillations around a region that is going to be recruited during a task. So we'll see an example where we have this happening. So even though I'm working in 30 or 40 dimension, I could not help but try and give you a sense of what's going on in three dimensions. So here, shown here is a scatter plot of 4,000 time samples. So each dot here is a three-dimensional brain collected at a given time. So somehow time flows on the data set here, and the captions are wrong. Basically, this is the first principal component, second and third principal component. And so this is chosen in terms of the best explanation of the variance, and the red circles corresponds to the training data, the green dot corresponds to the entire data set. So only at the red circles do I know the value of my function, and I'd like to interpolate it on the entire data set at all the green points.
So there is a green point in the center of each red circle.
That's a theorem. Okay. So this actually doesn't work so well because what happens, there's a large chunk of the data set where the training samples are not really covered. So I have a problem of sampling here. So this is a different subject. And same, you know, exactly same representation. This is a totally different data set. It's a different subject. But still, there's a large part of the data set that will not be very well covered. So these are, basically states where the subject is doing something in the game that will not be very well explained by the red circle.
So, François, could you tell me again that how the training data set was selected?
Okay. So I have basically three chunks, three parts. The first two parts I have all the information about. The first two parts are composed of a dot here, so I have a brain value, so the fMRI value for the first two parts, as well as those 25 features that are real valued functions that live on the data set that I need to be able to predict. And then for each green dot without a circle, I have only the fMRI data, so I don't have the 25 features. And I'd like to be able to predict, infer from the red circles the value at the green dots. Okay, so this is what we find when we're trying to use this the Plaisian idea. So basically now what we have is, again, same thing. A green dot corresponds to an fMRI data. Red corresponds to a place where we know the value of the feature. Here we've represented the new coordinate system provided by the value of the first three non-trivial eigenfunction. We suffer here from exactly the same problem. We have a sampling issue. We have lots of values here that are well represented, and this in this part of the domain, I know almost nothing about my functions. Okay. This is a better coverage. This is, again, a different subject. But there are still some places where we're not doing so well. Okay. So this is to give you some intuition how the algorithm is going to perform. And you will see that it's very difficult. It's a very hard problem. Maybe we're not doing it well. But so now let's get down to details. So all the experiments that I will be showing you, all the values, we actually end up doing some spatial averaging. The data are so noisy that so instead of working on the entire brain, we basically apply a low-pass filter and downsample. Of course, we remove voxel outside the brain. So we end up with a dimension of roughly about 4,000 voxel to characterize the brain state at any given time. We end up reducing to about 30 to 40 dimension, whether we're using linear principal component analysis or the eigenfunction of the Laplacian. Now, when we build the graph, this is an interesting observation. We started with a very small number of nearest neighbors, and we ended up finding that with a very large number, we have a better exploration of this high-dimensional data set. The choice of, to answer your question, Peter, the choice of the scale is, we actually work with very small scale, so we explore very locally on the data set. Which is probably consistent with this huge number of nearest neighbors. And how do we validate our algorithm? So we typically use the first half of the data set, so which is one third, to predict the second third and vice versa. So there we actually know what we're doing. We've just submitted 2 days ago the prediction for the third of the data set, and we're ready to get our results. So we'll see how well we do. So these are predictions. There were three subjects. Subject one is so bad that I didn't even bother showing it to you. There is a huge motion. In fact, you can almost correlate certain of the features with the motion of the head. So it's not very interesting. It's a highly corrupted data set. So here, there's a subset of the feature where we can at least present the data without being totally ashamed. So, those are really low numbers. They should be between minus 1 and 1. So numbers where we do reasonably well are instruction. So this is the time we need to, to predict the time at which the subject is going to get a cell phone order to ask him or her to do something. Clearly there is a very strong response inside the brain that where, the fMRI has a lot of good signature here. Otherwise, sometimes PCA does better, sometimes our algorithm is better. There's no very clear distinction here. Almost similar numbers here. So some of those feature vectors are sort of very subjective. Others are, like instruction, extremely objective. One thing that is interesting, for instance, is the search for faces here. This is a fairly decent a number here. And one possible explanation is that there is, these neuroscientists have this theory that there's a very well-defined region inside the brain where most of the processing of faces occur. And so this idea of using PCA to find the eigenbrains is completely consistent with the fact that one of those eigenbrains would be related to the processing of faces, and therefore we could, you know, get a strong, a very good prediction if we were to use this. So we basically need to go back and look at our eigenfunction and to see whether this correlates with the place where this phase fusiform area is. So this is the second subject where our algorithm does better, but not really, you know, an excellent job. It's still some very low numbers. Instruction is still very good comparatively. So we're doing, for instance, for sort of things that are probably not very well localized in space, we're doing much better in PCA, for instance, for this particular subject. So two subjects, that's, you know, that's not sufficient to do any sort of statistics, but this is encouraging. So obviously, this is just the first attempt. There will be more of this data set. So we need to think about a way to analyze functional neuroimaging data without stimuli. So we need to be able, first, to find a good metric to compare brain states. One thing that we were interested in is whether we could use, for instance, brain atlases that have large functional areas that, for instance, were discovered by BroadMind by looking at the architecture of the cells, and whether this knowledge could be, in a certain sense, leveraged to measure distances between brain states. An open question, how do we choose the number of eigenfunction? We've observed that if we use, for instance, more than 100 eigenfunctions, we lose our ability to predict. If we use too few, we again do not very well. There seems to be a regions where this is really optimal. But it was quite surprising to us that 30 or 40 is the optimal number. If we compare to the number of voxels that we collect, this is really small. So the other thing is, how can we, you know, find a strategy to sort of better sample that domain? You know, there clearly is a lot of work. So in summary, I've tried to share with you some interesting data set, really exciting for this community, where not only do we have the data, we have some feature vectors, and we can compare our ability to predict to the ground truth. We've tried to use some new coordinate system based on, you know, thinking about the brain as a dynamical system and studying sort of a state-space representation and trying to find a better parameterization of those different brain states. We find sometimes an improvement of our standard linear approaches, but there's lots of work that needs to be done. Thank you very much.